Возможно ли военная операция России в Сирии?
Россия усиливает свое военное присутствие в Сирии.
Вторая гибридная. Зачем сценарий заброски российских военных в Сирию напоминает?
Российских военных? Доказательств этому нет.
Да мы все комментарии уже сделали. Российские военнослужащие в Сирии есть.
Is hybrid war coming to the Middle East? Defying the West, Russia puts boots on the ground in Syria in an effort to prop up the tottering regime of Bashar al-Assad. Meanwhile, the Kremlin and its surrogates hint that Vladimir Putin will offer the West a grand bargain when he speaks later this month at the United Nations General Assembly. With Russia bogged down in a military and diplomatic quagmire in Ukraine, and with its economy reeling from sanctions and low oil prices, Putin has decided it's time to change the subject. What's the Kremlin's game plan in Syria? Is there a master strategy, or is it all just desperate improvisation? Hello from our broadcast headquarters in Prague, and welcome to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. Joining me on the Skype line from New York City is co-host Mark Galliotti, a professor at NYU, an expert in Russia security services, and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. Welcome, Mark.
Hey there, Brian.
And also joining us from London, also via Skype, is Alexander Clarkson, a professor of European and International Studies at King's College and a frequent commentator on post-Soviet affairs. Welcome back, Alex.
Hi, thanks.
And also joining us via Skype from Moscow is political analyst Vladimir Frolov. Welcome to the podcast, Vladimir.
Hi, thanks, Brian.
Great to have you. Well, Mark and Alex, you guys are guilty of giving me the idea to do this week because you both wrote excellent pieces on the Russian military buildup or apparent military buildup or whatever we want to call it in Syria. Mark, as I understand your argument, if I understand your argument correctly, you basically see this as transactional. Putin's trying to establish some facts on the ground in Syria in order to have something to bargain with the West over in exchange for lifting sanctions, a free hand in Ukraine, or whatever it is he's after. Is my characterization of your argument fair and correct? And would you elaborate on it a bit for us?
Surely, yes. Obviously, it's not that the Russians don't care about Assad or Syria at all. I think it's actually just trying to explain this most recent move. Clearly, on the one hand, the Assad regime is very much in trouble, and Alex has very sort of effectively charted that particular trajectory. But if we look at this deployment, first of all, I mean, it's too small to make a serious impact on the ground. I mean, we're talking about at the moment what looks like a battalion of the 810th Independent Brigade of Naval Infantry, which is fine for security to Latakia Airport, where they're going to run their drones from and that kind of thing, but not the sort of thing that's going to make any serious impact on the ground, not even as a kind of Praetorian guard to protect Assad. I mean, at best, they can probably look after the embassy and such like. Secondly, if they're going to actually have some kind of long-term impact, they're going to need to throw in a lot more troops, but more to the point, they're going to have a lot more secure supply lines than they have at the moment. Even if they're going to supply by air, we find more and more countries closing their airspace to Russian flights to Syria, and it's expensive and difficult. You can't really do that long-term. The Soviets found this with Afghanistan, and they actually had a border with Afghanistan. Most fundamentally, look, I cannot see Putin being willing to go to the wall for Assad. Yes, there is a degree in which prestige would be lost if Assad falls. But when it comes down to it, I don't actually think this is a regime that cares about other regimes particularly. I think this is much more likely, given that Putin is going to the UN for the first time in 10 years, this month, given that every single official and unofficial mouthpiece of the Kremlin is currently talking up that the West needs to be dealing with us against Islamic State. It is clear that they're trying to find small leverage points. Not that I think they think that this is going to suddenly sort of turn around their relationship with the West and have us all be allies again. They're just looking for small leverage points where they can say, well, actually, there are some ways in which you need us, and therefore you need to give some ground somewhere else. Right. So that's how I'm interpreting it.
There's some indication that may be working to an extent. If you looked at the piece in the New York Times today, there's a debate going on in the administration about whether to oppose the Russian buildup or to work with it. The people advocating working with it seem to be in the minority, and those that have dealt with Syria policy are dead set against it.
Yeah.
But it's worth noting, I mean, there's an extraordinary situation in which the United States was, even before the most recent deal, happy to work implicitly with Iran. Mm-hmm. Against Islamic State, but thinks, but come on, you know, the Iranians are one thing, but my God, the Russians, surely they're beyond the
well,
power.
That's true.
What that says is the extent to which actually no one cares about Syria, right. When we get down to it in geopolitical terms, all about the big picture.
Now, Alex, you focus more. I mean, because the difference between yours and Mark's pieces is a lot in nuance. But you focus more on the importance the Russian establishment attaches to maintaining Assad as an ally, and the loss of prestige of Russia as a great power should Assad fall. Is that correct? Is that a fair assessment of your argument? I know your piece doesn't do your piece justice. It was a very encyclopedic and extremely informative piece. Well, I learned a lot from it. But in general, is that your argument?
That is my argument. I mean, in many ways, I agree with Mark. I mean, this is transactional. And this is also about trying to find some way of doing a deal with the West in a broader sense. But I think that if you look at actually what the Russians are building up, and this is based on rumors going back to May. If you talk to a lot of Syrian activists, a lot of people from the Syrian side, and I, you know, Syria and Russia have become the target of conspiracy nuts. So, you know, for a while I thought, you know, this is not true. This they're just bigging this up for their own interests. And so as I, you know, as things progressed, it became increasingly concrete. And I thought, okay, this is something else is going on. I agree with Mark that this is not, as some of the more fevered imaginations are generating in the States, some huge intervention. It's a train and equip program. The British used to call it mentoring, right? Which is that you put a very small unit of soldiers, as Marcus described, to add some spine to a faltering Assad military. And what you do is ultimately try to reconstruct the Syrian army so that you can leave. But you still have people there that are dependent on you and give you leverage, right? Because without a Syrian military there, the Russians have nothing to transact. For a transactional strategy. And if you, so basically there's two points of disagreement here. The first point is that I don't think Putin controls the timetable of all of this. I think this is driven by events on the ground, which I can maybe explain a little later on in the podcast. And if Putin could have gotten away without putting one single soldier into Syria and run the strategy, he would have run the strategy on those terms. And he could have done before the fall of Idlib city in March. Show that actually if nobody came in and saved the Syrian Arab Army's bacon, there would be no proxy, nobody that could provide Russia with the leverage it needs. And I think the second point of disagreement is I think Putin does need the Middle East to maintain the shred of great power status that they want to remain a spoiler on the global stage. If they don't have any, and President Sisi in Egypt doesn't cut it because he's too dependent on Saudi subsidies, right? So all they have isn't Assad, it's the Syrian Arab Army and the Syrian intelligence services, with which they have a 40-year relationship. They have no one else. The Iranians are not Russia's allies. This is an alliance of convenience. The Iranians are running their own agenda. Without some kind of presence in Syria that gives them, they don't care about the outcome, but gives them a seat at the table of any Taif-style final accord in Syria, they can't act as a spoiler.
Yeah, no. One of my first thoughts looking at this is it reminds me. I mean, you know, the Soviet Union was able to project force all over the world, and they had interest in the Middle East and Africa and Latin America. And this is something that post-Soviet Russia really hasn't had. And this looks to me like one of the first attempts to truly project force outside of the former Soviet area in this kind of way, which is let's face it, something that's a necessary condition to being a great power. Vladimir, you've been writing about this as well. You had a piece in Sloan this week. Right. What are you, you've been listening to Mark and Alex. What are your thoughts on this?
Well, I think I would agree with Alex that a lot of it is driven by events on the ground. And it's obviously Putin is enlarging the Russian military footprint in Syria, not in order to fight IS, but to create leverage in Syria.
So you see it as transactional then?
It's a transactional in terms that because of the Syrian army and the Assad regime was crumbling so fast by August. They really had to go in to bolster up the regime because they were really losing leverage with Assad. Assad was being owned by the Iranians. And again, as Mark quite clearly and interestingly pointed out, you know, what unnerved Moscow was that Americans were much more interested in doing something on Syria with the Iranians, because they saw the Iranians as the guys who actually own the asset and could make an impact. And Russia was losing its leverage as a player, so they had to bolster up, without bolstering up their military presence and their military support for Assad, there was no way they could regain that leverage, and it's an effort to do that.
So this is an anti-Iran move as much as an anti-Western move?
It's all of the above. It's a move to bolster up Russia's position with regard to multiple players in the Syria, and positioning Russia for a better outcome in the end game. But there's also an element of a grand strategy, because it's so recklessly genius, to change the subject of the conversation with the United States and essentially to drag the United States into some kind of global interaction with Russia, and to show to the world audience that Ukraine is not an issue anymore between Russia and the United States, that everything is back to normal, and Russia and the United States are two huge geopolitical partners. It's a way for Putin to say, there is no single geopolitical issue that could be solved without me. So it's transactional and tactical on the ground. But militarily, I think what is important is that Putin does not intend to fight a ground war with the IS in Syria. I think it's more about deploying air power, air assets. And that's an absolutely new dimension to Russian military presence in Syria, which used to be limited to advisors, trainers, military interpreters, listening posts, but not deployment of fighters and air assets. And what is more, let's say, worrying and disturbing is that they're planning to deploy ground attack helicopters and ground attack aircraft, which actually makes it extremely volatile and escalatory.
Now, regardless of Moscow's motivations here, and I think we all seem to be on the same page about what Moscow's motivations are, more or less with slight nuances, isn't there a risk that that events on the ground could take on a logic themselves and Russia could find itself in a quagmire? Yes, we're not talking about fighting with ground forces. We're talking about air power. But if this Russian presence in Syria will become a target. And, I mean, Americans have bitter experience from Vietnam, and especially in knowing you start with some military advisors, they begin to get attacked, that you have to protect them with troops. Those troops begin to get attacked. You have to put more troops in. And before you know it, you're stuck in a quagmire. Is this a possible scenario? Is this a possible risk or pitfall? Anybody who wants to jump in?
I think it's an enormous risk. And you have to take a look at inter-rebel and IS-rebel dynamics in Syria to understand how risky a decision this is. So if you break down the rebel forces in Syria, you have Jaish al-Fatah in the north that's dominated by Ahrar al-Shams. You have Jaish al-Islam around Damascus. You have the southern front. Those are the three Sunni rebel armies. Then you have Islamic State. Then you have Jabhat al-Nusra, which is like a free agent across the country. They're all competing for legitimacy, right? They're all competing to be seen as the defenders of Syrian independence, or in Islamic State saying of global Sunni independence and identity against foreign invaders. If you slot in even a couple of hundred Russian troops into Syria, it makes them the primary target for any movement in Syria that's trying to protect project its image as either a defender of Islam against foreign invaders or defender of Syria against foreign invaders, right? You're making these people the primary targets. And these guys aren't jokers. I mean, I find it fascinating, just a final point, is that one of the problems is Russian media and the Russian media sphere and the Russian blogosphere and presumably the Kremlin tends to portray Syrian rebels and IS as one undifferentiated mass. They're not. They're, rebels and IS are two quite distinct groups of people, first of all. Second of all, as a bunch of bearded primitives, a few pot shots from the VDV and these fuzzy wuzzies will run away and will win. If you actually look at these rebel armies, and they're armies now of tens of thousands of troops, their leadership is made up of people who've gone through a Darwinian process of selection on the battlefield. Right? Over 4 years. All the ones who weren't good or weren't lucky, weren't any good or weren't lucky, are dead. Right? You're left with the most ruthless and skilled people on the battlefield. Mm-hmm. You have troops that have been fighting for 4 years. These are battle-hardened troops. These are armies. And they are well-equipped by a whole set of regional actors like Saudi Arabia and UAE with an unlimited stock, at least the three rebel armies, not IS, with an unlimited stock of anti-tank guided missiles, which could shred any infantry component the Russians send in. The Russians are also guilty of ignoring regional actors in this, by the way. Israel, Saudi Arabia, UAE, which is also dangerous, right? Mark, so this is the quagmire element.
Mark, you want to jump in, Mark?
Yeah, I mean, I think two general points and two specific ones. I mean, first of all, you compare this, is it strategy or is this desperate improvisation? All geopolitics is desperate improvisation from every side. And no one actually gets caught in a quagmire. It's not actually anything that is forced upon. I mean, the Russians will be in a position that if they want to pull out when they start taking casualties, they can. There will be no one stopping them except themselves. I think very much this will be how we discover what the real weight is for Moscow, whether or not actually Syria matters, or whether it was just simply a transaction. Because if Putin goes to New York and there's not any indication that the Americans are willing to make a deal with this, then Syria becomes much, much less important. And so in that context, so it'll be interesting to see whether at that point they're more willing to cut and run or whether they're willing to escalate. But then moving into the specifics, I don't think there's any suggestion at the moment that we're going to see Russian ground troops being deployed. This is very much a security contingent. At the moment, the Russians are very much, they're flying Chila drones. They may be, even if they start using sort of ground attack helicopters, which, yes, means people are going to get shot down and they're going to have pilots behind the lines.
But isn't there a potential for mission creep or no?
There always is a potential for mission creep. But let's be honest, it's not as though the Russians are the only people who have combat officers within Syria at the moment. You know, one could look at the Turks, one could look at the Americans. I mean, but I think to me, one of the more interesting snippets was just this little rumor that we're getting is that there's also special forces there, and not the kind of attacking Spetsnaz, but people in Damascus. Now, okay, they may well simply be doing embassy security and that kind of thing, but I'm minded to think in the latter days of the Iraqi regime, there was a force probably from Zaslon, which is the special forces unit of the federal, the Foreign Intelligence Service, whose role seems to have been not so much to provide protection, but that if everything did fall apart, make damn sure that maybe whether it's documents or electronics or other things they didn't want falling into the Americans' or others' hands didn't. In other words, they were sanitary engineers there to clean up just in case. And I wonder if at the same time as we have, with one hand, Russia is currently putting highly visible combat assets in supporting the Assad regime, with the other, it is putting rather more quiet assets in place, operating on the basis of, look, this is a regime that we know may well not survive. Because actually, there is a lot of talk within the Russian, especially the specialist press, about actually the limitations of the Assad regime.
Mm-hmm. Vladimir, your thoughts?
I think a lot depends on how the Russian forces would be used. And there are different scenarios about it, which I wrote in Sloan on this. And the crucial fact would be how air power would be used. It's one thing to, let's say, undertake long range airstrikes against Islamic State targets in eastern Syria in close coordination with the United States and probably in a cooperative way in target selection. But it's quite another thing to attack targets around Damascus and particularly in Idlib province, where other Syrian opposition groups and forces are located. Actually, Assad is not fighting IS in Idlib. He's only marginally exposed to fighting IS near Damascus. So If the Russians limit themselves essentially to reinforcing the Syrian army and the Syrian air force and attacking long-range IS targets in eastern Syria, that's one scenario, and it doesn't open the floodgates for the mission creep, and it doesn't put the Russians in confrontation with the United States and the international coalition. But if we as Alexander pointed out, and the Russian propaganda is quite simplistic about this, if we lump all those Syrian forces, opposition forces, together as terrorists, as Lavrov is saying, then it creates all kinds of problems. And then you have huge potential for a mission creep if you start attacking those groups. And it also puts the United States in a very unenviable position, because, you know, we have all those groups that have support from Saudi Arabia, from Turkey, from Qatar, and some of those groups have support, even combat support, from the United States. And how do you deal with this if the Russians and the Syrian army attack them as terrorists? That's a very dangerous and volatile situation.
That's brilliant, Vladimir, because you actually helped me segue exactly where I want to go. Because the thing, like I said earlier, one of the first things that popped into my mind when this happened is like, oh my God, we're back to like the proxy wars in the third world of the Cold War era. This is only one. But one has to wonder if that's where we're, if that's what this would, at the end of the day, turn into. If the West doesn't bite at this grand bargain Putin is appearing to try to offer, and if Russia decides to hunker down and essentially establish a frozen conflict in Western Syria or around Latakia, it's like bringing hybrid war to the Middle East, as I said in the intro. Are we going to be in this situation, or are we back to proxy wars between the Russia and the West?
I don't think it's a comparable situation. In both in Ethiopia, Angola, various other conflicts,
Nicaragua,
the Russians can the Soviets could control the timetable, right? Afghanistan was the case where they lost control of the timetable, right? Of the sequencing of events. In Ukraine, the Russians, because they caught us all by surprise, they controlled until about February, they controlled the sequencing of events, right? They could control what happens. In Syria, they can't control the sequencing of events. Just today, Jaish al-Islam has cut off the highway between Homs and Damascus, right? If the Russians want to reinforce Damascus right now, they might have to go through Lebanon. Mm. Now think about that. Think about the implications of that, right? The Saudis, the Israelis, the rumors about the Israelis actually providing supplies to the Southern Front. That's one of these three big rebel armies in the south, in Daraa and Quneitra, right? And the Israelis have been bombing the hell out of Hezbollah and Mount Qasyun and a whole belt of villages and towns where the Hezbollah has weapon stocks. Russia can't control the sequencing of events. So Putin puts himself in a position, even with the small complement, with the escalatory dynamic that you could see happen, of actually putting himself in a situation where he has no control, right? Where he's constantly reacting. The way we were constantly reacting to the Russians in Ukraine, he'll end up constantly reacting, particularly to what the Saudis, Israelis, and the three Sunni rebel armies do over the next couple of months, right? So I don't think it's comparable.
So as I implied this morning on the Daily Vertical, basically he looks like he has the initiative now, just like he looked like he had the initiative in the early stages of the Ukraine crisis, but he's going to lose the initiative very quickly. Awesome. Here, much quicker than he lost in Ukraine. Right. Mark, Vladimir, any thoughts on this, on this proxy war aspect of this? Are we entering potentially a new era of this, or is Alexander?
I'd say no. I'd say no. I mean, I think, first of all, this is not proxy war. This is just simply, you know, a slight extension of the existing support. It's not as though, after all, there's anything really new. You know, 300 soldiers do not make a big deal on exactly the sort of complex and rather expansive battlefield that Alexander has described. Of course, Putin doesn't have the initiative or anything like that. This is just simply a slight extension of what's happening. If he wants to try and start doing things like talking about creating a frozen conflict or anything more substantive than that, Russia will need to expand its commitment dramatically, and not just with drones and helicopters, but with a lot more ground forces and heavy ground forces of the sort that actually it's very hard to fly in. You're going to have to take by ship, and then it'll be really obvious because you've got umpteen bloggers and spooks in Istanbul gleefully watching every single heavy traffic transport ship that goes past, and there's not that much sea lift capacity either available. But nor is this hybrid war. I mean, to be honest, what's going on in Ukraine is not technically hybrid war, but unfortunately the term has become used. Right. This even is even less so. This is just a messy, multipartite civil war in which Russia is seeking to support the elements that it finds more congenial, just as Turkey and the United States and Saudis and everyone else is doing the same. I mean, I think we are giving Russia, on the one hand, too much importance, just because it's Russia, presumably, and because this is also a Russia wonk program. But also, I think we are actually...
I resemble that remark.
but also because I think exactly we are we are locating it rightly within a bigger narrative, the one that stretches back to when, frankly, they appointed Oleg Sieromolotov as a deputy foreign minister, you know, basically a former deputy director of the Federal Security Service suddenly becoming a deputy foreign minister, because precisely the Russians thought that counterterrorism cooperation is one of the ways that they can rebuild connectivities with the West. So this is what gives it also an additional context. But I mean, I really think we should beware about putting it into these bigger pictures of, you know, further hybrid wars, rise of new proxy wars, quagmires, Russia's Vietnam, or whatever. This is, at the moment, we're nowhere near that kind of stage.
Vladimir?
Well, I would agree. I don't think that's we are heading towards a proxy war unless Russia decides to strap itself too closely to Iran and become essentially a junior partner in Iran's proxy war with Saudi Arabia. And I don't think that's very likely. Probably Russia would provide significant material support to Iran's forces if Iran decides to defend Latakia as a, you know, Assad's allied stronghold and the strategic corridor to Damascus and the border with Lebanon, but not with ground troops and probably not with significant amounts of air support to Iranian forces. I think in terms of the proxy war, it's not nearly even close to what we used to have during the Cold War with the United States, and I think
And I wouldn't suggest it is. I'm just wondering if this is where he's moving.
I think there is some potential that he would provide more significant material support to Iran's forces in Syria, particularly Iran, because I think there are some reports that the Iranians are actually flying in regular forces and Qatar's force, Revolutionary Guards forces. And clearly this is the ground presence and the boots on the ground that the Russians would clearly use, given that the Syrian army is in a very sad shape and has some draft problems even among the Alawites. It's we're not heading towards a proxy war with the United States.
Mm-hmm. Alexander, you want to jump in?
I think there's two things about what's taking place, two things that sort of vaguely reminded me of. The first was, do you remember the American military commitment to Lebanon in the early 1980s?
Yes.
It was a half-baked plan. They were supposed to act as peacemakers. They didn't quite know what they were doing there. There was a mild escalation, but when it came down to it, the Americans pulled out. Mm-hmm. Right, but what triggered the pullout was 283 Marines killed in a suicide bomb, right? And I think that's the risk the Russians put themselves into. It, not so much that they're going to send divisions into Idlib to take the Gob plane. That's just not going to happen. But even this limited degree of risk can cause Putin a lot of harm. You just need a single suicide bomb, and suddenly Jaish al-Fatah or Jabhat al-Nusra or IS have a huge boost of legitimacy, and Putin has a huge problem at home. So that's the one thing I wonder about. The other thing you have to keep in mind is Assad's supporters and the Assads themselves. They have been celebrating Putin as the second coming of the Messiah for the last 3 days, 4 days. Right, so this is having an impact on the Assad regime, we should keep in mind. So there's also an issue of prestige where the Russians have boxed themselves into a corner, right, in the Middle East. The Middle East is now expecting the Russians, not the Middle East, but the Saudis basically, everybody watching is expecting the Russians to follow through. Now, if the Russians don't follow through, I really think that does have a big impact on their great power image in a region which is important for their being able to play this spoiler role globally. So I don't think Putin will go all the way, but when he doesn't, he still has a huge problem. And he's also exposing himself, even with a small complement of troops, to a huge risk.
Well, so then we look like it looks like two unpalatable outcomes here, either a huge blow to prestige or a quagmire and mission creep, right? No, Mark's shaking his head. Shoot me down. You're the military expert.
I mean, ultimately, the interesting thing is, as usual, this is not actually about military, but the politics behind it and the perceptions and the often sort of human-level stupidities. But I think let's take those two extremes. You know, said, oh, you know, huge loss in prestige or a quagmire. I think, again, to me, and I think this is one of the areas of difference between me and Alex, is I still don't think that for the Russians today, the Middle East is important in its own right. I still don't think that, frankly, almost any region, maybe, okay, China is an exception, but basically speaking, it's all about the West. It's
and
all
the
about
former Soviet Union. And the former Soviet Union.
Well, yeah, but I mean that's not really abroad, you know.
Careful, my friend.
Well, no, I mean in Russian terms. I mean, I'm amazed at, you know, the concept of near and far abroad, which for a while was even in Russia not politically correct, is back in quite regular discourse. But no, I mean, I think when it comes down to it, it is about the West, and I don't think that the Middle East matters in its own terms. And frankly, everyone is a cynic. Everyone knows exactly what's going on. You know, everyone plays other terms. But, you know, if let's say Russia has to pull out of Syria precisely because, let's say, there's some car bomb attack, or just simply they're not getting their goodies and they're thinking, look, either we're going to have to escalate dramatically to save this regime or just simply offer Bashar Assad, you know, a nice dacha. You know, after all, there's a lot of space now in the expat community around Moscow. You know, sort of an escape route. Yeah, I mean, on the one hand, it might be embarrassing, not necessarily domestically, because it will be massaged through a state-controlled media. Internationally, yeah, people might jump up and down, but it's not going to stop the Iranians playing the Russia card if they find it useful against America or whatever else. Yeah, you know, I mean, I think we always tend to assume that other people are much dumber than we are in understanding what's really going on. I don't think either we're likely to see a quagmire or a massive loss of prestige. You know, it might well be that this is an initiative which will fail and it'll be a story for a month or 3 months, but I don't think it's going to have a big impact globally, regionally, or domestically.
Just a quick sentence. I think the one thing we need to keep in mind is if the Russians want to play a spoiler and if they want to annoy the West and blackmail the West, the Middle East, that's why I think it's important to them. The Middle East is the key point, nodal neuralgic point for U.S. foreign policy. Mm-hmm. If you really, really want to get the Americans, drive the Americans up the wall, you basically mess them up in the Middle East. And that's why I'm thinking this actually plays a bigger role. Sorry, Vladimir, I've probably gotten you wrong.
But you don't need, need actually sort of presence there or whatever. I mean, like, you know, the issue of selling the Iranians high power, high effectiveness anti-aircraft systems that they can then use to protect their, of course, not military nuclear project. You know, the Iranians will happily buy them whether or not they think that the Russians are hot stuff or not. I mean, I think, again, in this respect, I think prestige and geopolitics often are less significantly connected than we may think. But anyway, sorry for jumping in there.
Okay. And, one other thing I wanted to hit before we hit the lighter second half, the second part of the program is the issue of overextension. I mean, it's a couple of other things caught my eye here. It's hard to miss it, but things have gotten noticeably quieter in Ukraine as things in Syria got dramatically more interesting. There's been reports that some of the elite forces that were involved in the initial stage of the Ukraine operation, particularly in Crimea, are precisely those that are going to Syria. And this one has to wonder with Russia bogged down in Ukraine, opening up another, albeit limited front, but a front nonetheless in Syria. Is there a risk of overextension here? I mean, sooner or later, the money's got to run out. This is an economy that's reeling, and this is a military that's stretched. We're into the fall draft season, where you're going to have fresh recruits coming in. Is there a risk of overextension here?
No, I don't think so.
No? Okay.
I don't think the Russian operation in Syria is extensive enough to create that kind of risk.
Okay.
Potentially, if they go the slippery path, but not at the moment.
Uh-huh.
And again, in Ukraine, in Donbass, Russia does not use air power. So mm-hmm. these are the units that are essentially free, and they could be deployed. And the Marines from Sevastopol, they played essentially no role in the Donbass where Russia is bogged down now. So I think for a while, they can manage it quite successfully.
Mm-hmm.
The last point is that if the United States does not, if the Obama administration did not show much interest in being transactional on Syria and Ukraine, then it would probably have a very limited exposure that that the Russians would do in Syria, particularly providing material support to Iran and some asset forces, but not deploying too much to be exposed.
I think from the Ukrainian perspective, this is great. I mean, this is just. Right. I agree with Mark and Vladimir that I don't see right now that it's a huge commitment. I think the commitment is going to be a bit bigger, maybe, than Mark and Vladimir are thinking about because of the possibility of mentoring Syrian units and that kind of thing. But the Ukrainians are loving this, right? The Ukrainian military establishment. I wouldn't be surprised if this does get worse. That there's some clever clogs in the Ukrainian SZRU coming up with some plan to make the Russians' life even worse in Syria. Ukraine has enough weapons to sell to everybody. You know, and that's been also one of the problems of Ukraine, corruption in the defense sector. But I think for the Ukrainian perspective, this is just, you know, this is a jackpot. And I think that's something Putin doesn't seem to have quite understood on the psychological effect this is having on the Ukrainian side.
Mark, any last thoughts before we move on to lighter matters?
I'd agree with Vladimir that this is not something that is currently overextending, that there's no direct connection. But on the other hand, at the moment, Russian intervention forces, the good forces, the ones that, for example, are not really affected by the draft because they're predominantly or all professional, they are pretty much at full, shall we say, comfortable stretch with the rotations through the Donbass. There's a scope for a little bit of a surge in the Donbass if they wanted to. But if they wanted to start actually sort of maintaining, for example, a high tempo within the Donbass and be deploying these kind of forces to Syria, that would become a problem. And this is another reason why I don't think the Russians are thinking in those terms. Now, okay, events might change their calculations, but I think at the moment this is bearable. But I'd also want to just sort of disconnect. I don't think there is any real connection between ramping up their affairs in Syria and quiet in the Donbass, because actually we're also seeing a variety of other interesting developments within that region, particularly the politics that's taking place. I mean, I think it is more that just this is a stage in which actually Russia is concentrating on trying to, insofar as it is able to do so, reassert some degree of control over the political agendas inside the Donbass rather than anything else. I don't think it's that anyone is sort of looking at this as one game board. And if the Ukrainians do try and actually start messing things up, given that, precisely as Alex said, it's probably someone who's smarter than from being for his own good. Actually, I think it will be a big mistake. I think the Ukrainians should just sit back and count their blessings at the moment rather than try and extend them.
Okay, well, in a few moments, we'll continue our discussion and shift gears, taking a look at the latest expose of top Russian officials displaying wealth beyond their officially declared means. I'd like to remind you, you're listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFURL. Joining me on the Skype line from New York City is co-host Mark Eliade, a professor at NYU, an expert in Russia's security services, and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. Joining us from London, also via Skype, is Alexander Clarkson, a professor of European and International Studies at King's College and a frequent commentator on post-Soviet affairs. And joining us from Moscow is foreign affairs analyst Vladimir Frolov. I'd also like to remind you, you can subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You can read the Power Vertical blog and watch the Daily Vertical at rfurl.org. And you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical. Gucci, Fendi et Prada, Valentino, Armani, Tour, Merde, I love them, Jimmy Choo. Well, it seems the Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov's $620,000 watch was just the beginning. We've just been introduced to Federation Council Speaker Valentina Matvienko's $100,000 watch and her $45,000 earrings, as well as a whole slew of expensive jewelry being worn by everybody from Russia's health minister and accounts chamber head to Moscow's deputy mayor. And we've been introduced to it all thanks to Alexei Navalny's Anti-Corruption Foundation. Mark, Navalny's been doing this for a while. It's nothing new. Although he kind of went for the glam factor this time, going with female officials with fancy earrings instead of Kremlin spokesmen with their expensive and I might add ugly watches. But one has to wonder, with the economy reeling and living standards dropping dramatically, with bans on Western food in place, people having to give up things they like, does this kind of thing have more bite now?
Honest answer, I don't really know. In fact, I'd be fascinated to hear Vladimir's point of view as someone who's actually there on the ground. I mean, at the moment, I get the sense not. And I think this is in some
That's
ways
what I get. I
a
get the
classic.
Same sense, actually.
This is a classic Navalny thing, is that he focuses on the things that actually are fun, especially for the sort of chattering metropolitan Muscovite set. But given that I didn't think many Russians honestly would be shocked or surprised to hear that powerful figures indulge themselves with ludicrous and appallingly ugly bling. that's a little bit like sort of saying, you know, that they also drive foreign cars instead of Ladas. No one is going to be set back. Now, okay, I mean, one might say yes, but these things can have a symbolic impact or whatever. But again, I almost feel this is the kind of fun stuff that Navalny too often gets involved with, rather than the boring nuts and bolts political campaign things. Now, we've got, after all, a whole slew of local elections that taking place, gubernatorial ones, mayoral ones, local assemblies and such like. And indeed, and Navalny's, on the one hand, calling for protests on the 20th of September in Moscow. And also his party is involved in the Kostroma elections, which is actually, well worth noting. I think that kind of stuff is more important than the kind of glitz, hey, look at this person.
Well, isn't this all part and parcel of the same thing, though? This plays into the whole broader narrative he's bringing to bear on this regime, and has been bringing for years.
It's a distraction. I think the key point, the one thing he hasn't successfully done is to connect in the minds of ordinary Russians why things in their own lives are actually the product of decisions that are made. That actually, so Peskov's watch. Why does Peskov's watch explain why your road is still full of potholes? I think that is the key thing, and that's the thing. Unfortunately, Navalny has not yet done.
Mm-hmm. Vladimir, your thoughts on that?
I would agree with Mark broadly. I think that does not. It has some impact on the chattering classes and it's media attractive, but does not have much impact on voters' preferences in Navalny's favor or any change in the public mood. I think the Russians, more broadly speaking, if you go outside of some of the elite circles, well, the Russians generally assume that their elites are corrupt and that they live a lavish lifestyle, and that's an acceptable part, of being a successful Russian. They don't expect them to dress in Uniqlo. They expect them to wear expensive stuff and drive expensive cars. This is not France, where President Sarkozy paid huge political costs for ordering a 9 euro coffee.
Right.
Espresso. That's not going to happen in Russia.
But doesn't this bite more as the economy gets worse and people's living standards go down? I agree that Russians tend to accept this kind of thing when times are good. But what about when times are bad?
Answer is that we don't really know how this would play out. And I think it would take a much more significant economic deterioration of the economic situation for that kind of thing to bite. So far, it's manageable and bearable, and people just don't pay attention to this.
This is obviously my specialism is more Ukraine and North Africa and their diasporas and all that. But I mean, just looking from those two perspectives, there's two things that struck me about the story. The first thing was simply that when Ben Ali and the Trabelsi family fled, and when Yanukovych fled, this is the kind of stuff they took with them. Right? The watches, the bling. My impression is this is like, on the one hand, I don't think the Russian public is necessarily getting this or seeing this, but this is obviously their escape strategy, right? If Peskov has to run because the mob's about to burn down his house, these watches are what is going to get him through. So that's just the impression I had just looking at the way other regimes have fallen. But that's sort of just a vague observation about what this stuff is probably for. I don't know whether the Russian public will take that in. My observation is more about Navalny, in that from a Ukrainian perspective, he just kind of reminds me of a classier Oleg Lyashko, who is a kind of he sort of plays up a certain populist card, he plays a certain function, but actually, if the Putin regime ever did go down, I don't think he's going to appeal to a wide audience, and that there will actually probably be people who come up, are less theatrical, but more ruthless, and more in touch with what's happening and what people actually are concerned about in the provinces, then they'll come up and supersede him, right? Mm-hmm. That's just my impression, just looking from what happened in Ukraine, that, you know, he's gonna, you know, Liashko got all these headlines and people paid all this attention to him, and that was that. And he's still a great act. And I just wonder whether we're also just putting too much value into what Navalny's doing in his role.
I would disagree that there is a parallel with Leshko. Okay. I mean, Leshko is a public clown. Navalny certainly is not a clown. He's a much more substantive and much more serious.
Yeah, no, I have a lot more higher regard for Navalny, whether or not he's going to be the one that walks in after.
A fair parallel. I think Mark is right that he has not made the right connection in communicating to a larger Russian audience between the bling thing of the Russian allies and the sad state of the social services, the sad state of roads and corruption. Well, they did try and are still trying to make this point in Kostroma. It's the only regional election where they were allowed to get on the ballot.
Yeah, exactly.
They were stricken down from the ballot by the authorities in all other regional elections. And there is a fair argument to say that they have been failing to make this argument persuasive. At least the latest polls that we could see on Kostroma do not make it clear that they would cross the 5% threshold, even though the campaign polling asserts that they're already polling above 5% in Kostroma. So we'll see if actually after this election, this weekend,
yes,
whether they were successful in making this connection or not, even in one very poor region. Kostroma is essentially a devastated area in terms of economic development. So it remains to be seen. And I would agree with Mark that so far it has not been very effective.
Well, this weekend's elections are kicking off a political season that's going to follow into the Duma elections and the presidential cycle and everything. How much importance should we attach to the results are one thing, but there's the results, and then there's the feeling that comes out of the election, whatever that may be. The authorities are going to see the real results and what the public opinion really looks like before it's massaged to meet their needs. How much importance is attached to this weekend's local elections? Anybody?
Well, I'll throw in my thoughts, I mean, which is, look, there's never going to be any doubt as to what the actual outcomes are going to be. That's, in a way, not the point.
Right.
The point is precisely how much effort has to be put into, for want of a better expression, buying the correct and appropriate outcome. I mean, if one looks at what's happening in Kostroma, I mean, there is a veritable plethora of the usual dirty tricks being applied. Precisely to keep the sort of opposition alliance down. You've got their campaign manager currently under investigation. There was this fake US diplomat sort of turning up. I mean, all kinds of things, ranging from the laughable to the much more serious. And elsewhere on the whole, it was because they were basically using the signature filter to ensure that opposition candidates were not there on other elections. So, you know, of course, they're going to control the outcome. The imponderable is how much effort they've had to put into it, and whether they feel they're having to put that much more effort into it than in past times. I mean, I think that's the interesting thing, and that's going to be the one thing that, frankly, we're not going to know, because that's not going to come out in any opinion polls. No one's going to be admitting that or whatever. There's no transparent campaign finance records that we can look at. This is our problem. We're just going to be trying to guess it from the hints that we get subsequently.
Mm. Vladimir, would you agree with that?
In a way, yes. I think we would not really know how much effort the authorities would put into making the election results look acceptable to them or sellable to the public. But this particular election is important in the sense that it would determine what parties would be allowed to participate in the Duma elections without signature collection. And I think this election is crucial for Navalny's party because right now they're eligible to participate based on having one seat in the Yaroslav Regional Duma Council. And they need to reinforce that position by being able to cross the 5% threshold and get elected at Kostroma, because otherwise they would be really vulnerable to, you know, Yaroslav Duma essentially disbanding itself one day and calling for a runoff election.
Which I think is a very predictable thing to happen.
Yes, which is a trick that is... could be in the cards. So for them, it's a very important election. For others, I think it's important for United Russia to make the point that they have not been losing much support, and the polls give them a lot of support right now, above 50%. And it would be a very important election for Just Russia Party. They need to demonstrate that they're still viable, viable contender for the Duma election. They might be the ones that might not get to the next Duma.
Alex?
Just as an outside observer, the one electoral process that kind of fascinated me was the one in Tatarstan. These kind of early elections for the Premier, basically Minikhanov's is Shaimiev's guy, right? And what I found odd was the messaging about this early in March. I think Putin made a grand announcement and he met Minikhanov, and there's this weird transcript. That's the one thing that did stand out for me was not that election, because we know who's going to win, but the aftermath of it, because there's this very particular relationship between Kazan and Moscow that could get messed up very easily.
One of the key issues in that election, and one of the key issues that Minikhanov is spinning, is that if he will keep the title of president, which is a very important symbolic thing for people in Tatarstan. Mark, any last thoughts before we wrap it up? We're bumping up against the time limit.
Well, in that case, I'll say no.
No, I want you to say something. Go.
No.
I said that for dramatic effect.
No, I mean, in some ways, the election is less important, although, you know, I take Vladimir's points. But it'll be interesting to see how the coverage afterwards happens. Does the state seem to decide to make some grand narrative out of it about how Russians are happy with how things are going? Or is it just a convenient, necessary piece of the management of the system, and then they just simply move on?
Okay. All right. Well, that's all we have time for today. I'd like to remind you, you have been listening to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFRL. Joining me on the Skype line from New York City has been Mark Galeotti, a professor at NYU, an expert in Russia security services, and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. Joining us from London has been Alexander Clarkson, a professor of European and International Studies at King's College and a frequent commentator on post-Soviet affairs. And joining us from Moscow has been foreign affairs analyst Vladimir Fedolov. Thank you all for an enlightening and lively discussion.
Always a pleasure.
Thanks, pleasure.
Always a pleasure here, too. And I'd also like to thank our brilliant, patient, and ridiculously overworked producer, Tanya Koncheva, and my indispensable and totally awesome colleague, Pavel Butorin, proprietor of the equally indispensable and awesome Twitter feed, Russia Police Watch, which you can and should follow at Rus Police Watch. I'd also like to remind you could subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You can read the Power Vertical blog and watch the Daily Vertical at rfrl.org. And you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical. The Power Vertical podcast will take a few weeks off as I'll be doing some traveling both for business and pleasure. But we'll be back in action on October 9th. And now, as always, I leave you with the ambient sounds of my favorite socially conscious Russian rapper, Noise MC.